I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Aaron Copland, who would be 100 years old in November of this year, has not been supplanted as the American composer who caught the imagination of a wide American public. His colleague Ned Roram said once in a TV tribute in Copland's old age that he had invented out of the whole cloth what it meant to be an American. Long before that, during World War II, Andrei Kostolanitz had commissioned Copland to write a piece that mirrored, as he said, the magnificent spirit of our country. What Copland wrote was the Lincoln portrait, combining a turkey in the straw sound of barn dancing with Lincoln's own words about the eternal struggle between two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. It was music that still raises goosebumps at home and abroad with an evocation of Americanism. Aaron Copland's birthday and his centennial arrive in November, but our guest, Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops, has opened the celebration this spring with his first Pops performances. We're listening to Copland this hour and recalling this rather surprisingly unschooled American classicist. The Copland Connection phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. This, of course, is Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. Keith Lockhart, that's your pal John Williams and predecessor conducting your band in the Fanfare for the Common Man. Welcome back, Keith.
Thanks,
Lockhart.
Chris. Always great to be here, and what a great occasion to be here for.
Yeah. He came from Brooklyn. Where did the music come from?
You know, I think that's the essential question of Aaron Copland. People, even doing educational concerts, you ask the kids, you play music from Rodeo, music from Appalachian Spring, music of wide open spaces, music of the frontier, music of America, and then you say, well, this whoever wrote this must have had a real wide-ranging experience with the plains of Oklahoma, right? And no, he was a Jewish kid from Brooklyn who very, except for some sojourns in Mexico, very rarely spent any time in the American West, not until after he wrote those pieces, actually.
What is the music of it? I mean, how does a musician who sees the chords and the spacing of those intervals and the Copland sound connect that to what we're hearing and what we're seeing, I mean, including the American West? And
well, I think it's Copland is an interesting development as an American composer. And I think to understand his development, I think a little you have to look at what he came out of. The history of American music is, from a classical point of view, is very young history. And one of the neat things that's happening now is that we're getting our first icons. We're getting our 100th birthday celebrations of Gershwin and Ellington and Copland. And that's not just a calendar coincidence. I think that kind of shows that in a way we're coming of age. But the 19th century history of American classical music was largely one of derivation. It was largely one of trying to emulate European musical molds because it was felt that they were the only people who had it right. And Copland, in his young and angry years, was extremely critical of people, including his teachers, people like Parker, people like Chadwick and Cadman, the people of the first Boston School, as it was called, who basically he felt were insisting on writing bad Elgar, bad Brahms, bad Wagner, when he felt as they should be searching for something that was uniquely American. And his whole compositional career, and it wasn't always, by the way, Fanfare for the Common Man in Appalachian Spring, was searching for that unique voice.
He he was also at war, I suppose, with American orchestras who were still playing good Elgar, good Brahms, but also the bad stuff too. There was a famous comment by, was it Walter Damrosch?
Ah, yes,
Of the New York
that's a
Symphony,
great
who played his organ,
New York Symphony.
who played Copland's organ symphony in 1925, and turned to the audience as soon as the piece was over, and he said, "If a young man can write a piece like that at the age of 24, in 5 years he'll be ready to commit murder."
that's a famous and oft quoted moment, but I think, lest we feel too sorry for Copland, he actually had he hit American music at the perfect time. He had opportunities. He had conductors who were champions of his work from a very early age. For a man in his mid-20s, he, at the point that he was having the organ symphony done by Damrosch and the New York Philharmonic Society, he was also working on two commissions for Koussevitzky and Boston.
Boston was very good to him.
Boston was, and Koussevitzky in particular was very good for him, all the way up into naming him Dean of Students at Tanglewood in 1940. That was a long relationship, and that relationship started with the piano concerto and with the music for the theater. But the Copland that that most of our audience is familiar with is a Copland that's 20 years later than that. That's the Copland of Fanfare for the Common Man. Interesting story about Fanfare for the Common Man, which I happen to know because it was written for the Cincinnati Symphony for my previous employers before coming to Boston, was that Goossens asked for each major American composer to compose a fanfare in support of the war effort, thought that would be their patriotic duty to do so, and that would be a nice show of unity. And everybody came up with rather prosaic sort of things. It's fanfare for the Merchant Marine, and fanfare for the Fighting French, and fanfare for this, and And Copland looked at all these things and said, "I want something that more generically speaks to the spirit involved." And funny enough, his Fanfare for the Common Man, with that kind of more lofty idealism, is the only one that's still performed of all those fanfares by illustrious composers. But perhaps most of Copland's reputation in current circles rests on his 1944 ballet score, Appalachian Spring, which we're also playing this week at the Pops.
Well, let's play it right now out of the the Pops file. This is also John Williams conducting it, but introduce the idea of Appalachian Spring, a ballet for Martha Graham, was it not?
For Martha Graham, I think it's arguable that Copland, along with Stravinsky, were the two most important 20th century ballet composers. And Copland, a huge string of success in the late 30s and early 40s, starting with Billy the Kid in 1938, Rodeo in 1942 for Agnes DeMille, and this collaboration with Martha Graham in 1944. Appalachian Spring tells the story of a young pioneer couple in the western hills of Pennsylvania, early part of the 19th century, and there's something about it that captures a yearning for a simpler life that maybe Americans in the 40s were looking to go back to. Whole 30-some-odd minute ballet score, Copland only uses one folk tune, and that's the Shaker hymn Simple Gifts, which is quoted here very near the end of the ballet, actually. The funny thing about this ballet, Appalachian Spring, is that it was not intended to be a Shaker ballet. Copland was drawn to the simplicity of this tune and the simplicity of the message, 'tis the gift to be simple. And the other funny thing is that Copland didn't have any idea until about 2 days before the previews that it was going to be called Appalachian Spring. That title is from a poem by Hart Crane that had attracted Ms. Graham's imagination, but it doesn't even refer to spring as in the season. It refers to spring as in a source of water. Mm. And Copland said for years afterwards, everybody came up to him and said how they could see the Appalachians and hear the and see the rustle of spring in his music. And he said, "Well, that's remarkable. I'm beginning to see it myself."
Lockhart, what do we want to say analytically about the music? We can hear, I mean, anybody can hear sort of what's American about it. What made it modern? What made it serious music?
Well, a lot of Copeland's contemporaries took big exception with this turn in his writing. What we'll see in a moment, I think, is that Copeland's writing was for the first 15, 20 years of his writing career was nowhere near this accessible, this user-friendly, this instantly audience-gratifying. It wasn't based on folk tunes or the perception of folk tunes. It didn't have these kind of highly consonant harmonies. I think Copeland objected strenuously because Copeland's idea was that by doing this, he was developing a voice that he thought was both unique and modern and reached an audience. I think, grew tired of the kind of intellectual composers playing for each other sort of school that he was inhabiting in the 20s and 30s. I think this music is modern and classical because it takes European orchestral conventions of incredibly sound orchestration, wonderful voicing, good counterpoint, and adds an element that hadn't been added to them before, the same way that Dvorak took the 19th century European symphony and put something that was profoundly Czech in without necessarily taking Czech folk tunes and orchestrating them.
But it's interesting. I mean, it's somewhere between, well, it's a lot of different elements. Virgil Thomson quoted American tunes. Charles Ives quoted American tunes in a much more difficult way.
Yes,
but Dvorak sort of made up going
way.
Home sort of spiritual melodies as if they were
American
folk tunes.
And Copeland did as well. I mean, in Appalachian Spring, which is a ballet that all sounds like it springs straight from the American soil, Simple Gifts is the only folk tune in a 40-minute piece. Everything else is straight from the mind of the composer, but so in sync with that. And again, as you said, where did this music come from? It obviously didn't come from the streets of Flatbush.
Well, I guess not. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Aaron Copland connection at the start of his centennial celebration. Born in Brooklyn in November 1900, the still unchallenged king of classical American and popular symphonic music. With Keith Lockhart this hour, maestro of the Boston Pops Orchestra. 1-800-423-8255. Jeff is on the line.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for calling, Jeff.
Yes, I'm a great big fan of Copeland and of Sergei Prokofiev as well. And these are two different composers from two different worlds, almost. But I find that there is so much in common in their music, and I was wondering if I could get your guest to comment on maybe a connection between Prokofiev and the American composer Copeland.
Well, it's an interesting idea, Jeff. I hadn't really thought of there being. I mean, they inhabited very similar time frame, and it's also interesting to note that Copeland, in addition to his skills as a composer, was a constant writer on and commentator on the subject of music, especially on modern music, and was known for actually being quite caustic and unforgiving. Though he was not particularly fond of negative reviews himself, proceeded to diss many of his contemporaries, including Henry Cowell on one end for being just an experimenter, not a true composer, Howard Hanson for being too conservative. But amongst the Russians, Prokofiev is the one that he stated clearly that he thought had the advantage in terms of imagination, compositional insight over Dmitri Shostakovich, who was his direct competitor. I'm interested to hear what you find in common between them from a compositional point of view. Obviously, Copeland respected his music.
Well, I didn't know that Copeland had said this about Prokofiev. I find that when you listen to Prokofiev, you find an awful lot of Russian sounds that that weren't necessarily classical and you know from the fundamental point of view,
mm-hmm.
but that he would incorporate these into his larger into his pieces. And I find that when you listen to Copeland, particularly like Appalachian Spring, that you find the same method of let's say picking out something neat, something what Copeland might have thought was typically American, and bringing that into a classical.
I suppose that's true. Some of the ballet suites like Alla and Loli and Alexander Nevsky, for instance, make use of this kind of primal Russian music that sounds like it came, you know, from somewhere in the steppes 1,000 years ago, even though, you know, it probably came straight from the mind of Prokofiev. And I suppose that way they were both in touch with the audience they were writing for and the roots that they had sprung out of.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Jeff, thank you. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Copeland connection.
You know,
Keith Lockhart, go ahead.
Please, I didn't mean to step on you there.
No.
We've been talking a little bit about how, you know, when you make a comment like the Walter Domrosch comment, people these days who are used to hearing the hoedown from Rodeo and Appalachian Spring and Fanfare for the Common Man and Lincoln Portrait, they go, what was this guy talking about? Even in 1925, Copeland's music could not have been so controversial that the august conductor of the New York Philharmonic would have said that it was akin to musical murder physical murder, for that matter. I think it's important to drop back a little bit and look at Copeland the young firebrand, the 24-year-old composer who came back from studying with Boulanger and living in Montparnasse and drinking deep of the kind of artistic ferment that was going on in Paris in the 1920s. And he came back and he wrote music that was truly controversial. Some of it these days has never really been revived back into performance. The piano variations, which became the orchestral variations, is one thing. The Symphonic Ode, which was written for the Boston Symphony, which Koussevitzky programmed in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Boston Symphony and never played again, and which got one recording in its entire life, and that was when Copeland chose to do it himself in the 70s with the London Symphony. But Copeland also came back to America trying to find, even at that point, an American way of saying things. And he settled on, this is a year after Rhapsody in Blue, the first piece that came from the American side, bringing jazz into a symphonic context, albeit from the popular side of coin as opposed to the classical side of the coin. And a year and 2 years later, he came up with the piano concerto and music for the theater.
Do you want to, let's revive it right here on the connection. Do you want to cue it and introduce it?
Well, this is the second movement of the piano concerto. It's performed by Aaron Copland at the piano with the Columbia Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Similar music. This is an example of something very, very different indeed. And you can imagine this not resting on 1920s ears anywhere near as smoothly as some of the later Copeland would.
Did you mean to say he was goaded into doing this by Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue? What was his relationship with Gershwin?
His relationship? No, I don't think he was goaded into it. I think this was a time where a lot of composers were coming to the same idea at the same time, kind of a synthesis. And that idea was that American classical music needed to have something that was distinctly American. And one of the voices that everybody was saying, including the Europeans, was highly indicative of that was jazz. It was one thing that the Europeans did not have, that they were importing in droves, bringing it over to Paris and saying, listen to this really cool thing that the Americans have come up with. And so from both sides, from the side of the popular composer like Gershwin and the side of the classical composer, they tried to incorporate elements of that into traditional symphonic molds, and the results were quite spiky.
This is terrific. I'm very glad you brought this to the fore. Aaron Copland's piano concerto with himself at the piano premiered
in 1926, just 2 years after Rhapsody in Blue and Boston Symphony, by the way. Jazz references that kind of unmistakable. The beginning is a little more spiky atonal, but here he comes into something that's kind of a knockdown, dirty Harlem blues sort of thing.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Aaron Copland connection. with the Boston Pops conductor, Keith Lockhart. Kathy is calling from Pocatello, Idaho. Welcome, Kathy.
Hello, Chris. I love your show.
Well, thank you.
Keith,
we
too.
Love Pocatello.
Hello.
Oh, that's good. I have a question, very specific question. There's two pieces of music that I can't listen to without crying. One is Appalachian Spring, and one is Ray Vaughan Williams' Lark Ascending.
Oh, two of my favorite pieces in the whole world, so I guess we share an emotional connection there.
And, in fact, you got me all teary playing Appalachian Spring in the background.
Me too, Kathy. I was surprised. It just snuck up on me.
It pierces my heart. Mm. It's just incredible. But I was wondering if there's any connection between Aaron Copland, who's one of my favorite composers, and Ray Vaughan Williams, who's my absolutely most favorite composer, in their use of, like, English folk tunes and American folk tunes in the music.
Well, it's another interesting question. I have to say I've been doing just a little bit of Copland's centennial reading, and the one thing that I hope won't burst your balloon is that Copland spare no expense to just completely discredit Vaughan Williams at every step of the way in all of his writing. He basically, he was very much a Francophile for his whole life, which almost means de facto that you're against
exactly.
The English for some reason or another. And he felt that all of the 20th century English composers, with the exception of Benjamin Britten, he liked what they were coming from in terms of looking for folk tunes, but he thought basically that their music was unadventurous. I don't share that assessment. I love Vaughan Williams' music, and I love conducting it, but for some reason, if there was a connection there, Copland didn't see it.
Well, there's sure a connection of the heart, though, I think. There's
I think
some simplicity, and it really, those and two pieces just make me weep.
Genuineness, sincerity.
Yes, very true. Thank you.
Kathy,
thank you for calling 1-800-423-8255, the Copland connection. Jason is calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello, lovely show. Nice to talk to you, Mr. Lockhart, as well.
Thanks.
Wanting to know some specific assessment of a couple of later tunes, which I've heard deem modern, and until recently I haven't had a good chance to listen to them, both Down a Country Lane and Hear Ye, Hear Ye.
Mm-hmm. Well, those are actually not later. Hear Ye,
Not
Hear
Ye. Latter, okay.
They're actually fairly, it's funny, with most of Copland's repertoire, it's the earlier stuff that strikes one, the ear, as being more modern. Down a Country Lane is, we're actually performing that with the Pops this year on our Evening of Pops special. It is, I think, early 1950s, so it is on the later side, but it was written for a magazine, a national magazine, which the specific magazine escapes me. They asked for Copland to submit a piece that was attractive to its readers and could be played at the piano by people of moderate ability. He wrote the piece first as a piano piece and was published in a national, just kind of a general circulation magazine. Then Copland liked the piece, and it very much fits kind of the Grover's Corners, Our Town, Appalachian Spring sort of gestalt. And he orchestrated it out himself, and it's a lovely piece of music. Hear Ye, Hear Ye is a ballet score dating from the 1930s, I think, though I'm going to have a host of Copland authorities down on me for that. And I really don't know much about it, but it's interesting that those are the two pieces that have kind of stuck out for you.
Hmm. Is there any kind of commentary that makes in terms of what might sound modern to be in actually the earlier part of his career, any kind of particular evolution he has as an artist?
Well, I think the evolution is, he talks a lot. One good thing about Copland, as opposed to a lot of composers, is that he actually self-criticized and talked about his development and talked about what was going on in his mind when he made different decisions along the way. And one of his, he talks a lot about the period of the late 1930s, early 1940s, when he basically said that he felt that his music was passing his audience by, where he was kind of tired of being an enfant terrible. He didn't just want to make an impression on people that was negative. He wanted to have some sort of communicative force. And I think that's what the change towards a sound that was more, how to say it, user-friendly is rooted in.
Jason, thank you for mentioning Hear Ye, Hear Ye. We're going into the break with part two of his music for the theater. With Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops, this is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is the Aaron Copland Connection. This is the Buckaroo Holiday from Aaron Copland's ballet score Rodeo, performed by the Boston Pops, conducted by our guest Keith Lockhart. This is from the CD American Visions. Tell us about Rodeo.
Rodeo was Copland's first chance to collaborate with another great American creative force in the mid-century, Agnes DeMille. And she approached him about doing this ballet in 1941, I think. It was to be a cowboy ballet, as Ms. DeMille put it, and it was to have it had to do with the goings on, the hard work, and the play and the courtship on a ranch in the American West, mid 19th century. Ms. DeMille said, actually, and she got a lot of flack from feminist forces about this, she said that the basic theme of the ballet was very simple, that it concerned a search that had occupied American women, or women in general, since the dawn of time, and that was how to find a suitable man. And people thought that was degrading, and what she responded was, well, she thinks that, thought that was far more degrading about the general level of man available than it was to women.
Should we listen?
Sure.
Keith Lockhart, I got to ask you, what's it like to conduct this stuff?
Oh, this stuff, this is, I don't know, I mean, you know, it's, if, as a conductor, you have to be a generalist. I mean, you have to be able to do Debussy one day and Mahler the next day and not
maybe
think,
1 minute to a minute.
Exactly. You can't say, well, I'm not a French conductor, so I can't do that repertoire. But there is something about one's own music. This music feels like the music of the country that I was brought up in. It feels like my music. I feel very, very comfortable in this.
You have Appalachian roots yourself, as I recall.
Well, a little bit. A little kind of mid-Ohio, sort of mid-Ohio Methodist sort of pretty unexciting roots, I suppose, but basic. But it really is, there's something about the rhythmic vigor, the vitality of this music that just, I've been conducting, I've still got a fairly brief career, but I've conducted so much Copland in it.
Oh, may you do it forever. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Copland Connection with Keith Lockhart. Mary is on the line.
Yes, hello. Thanks.
Welcome, Mary.
Show.
Thank you.
I'm lucky to be a member of a 200-voice community chorus up in Newburyport on the North Shore.
Wow.
And one of the great thrills of that for me was one spring concert when we sang a number of the Copland songs, including my favorite, The Promise of Living.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered, I know that that's part of a larger work about which I do not know much. I would love to hear more about it, and I think that that work was not particularly successful compared to other of Copland's works. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, and also to mention that I very much enjoy a recording by a singer named Bruce Hubbard. I believe it's called American Songs, where he sings a number of Copland pieces that I think listeners would enjoy.
Well, we'll tell
Mary,
you,
thank you.
We'll tell you a little bit more about it after we hear it, because it just so happens that that was the next piece on our playlist. This is The Promise of Living, Tanglewood Festival Chorus, Boston Pops Orchestra, John Williams conducting. Promise of Living is from a 1954, I believe, Aaron Copland opera called The Tender Land, which was received with moderate acclaim, probably less than Copland, as a composer of his stature, felt that it deserved. It's a very beautiful opera, and I've had the opportunity to perform some of the orchestral music from it. There are two great choral moments, this and a really wild square dance called Stomp Your Foot. And it has some beautiful vocal writing in it. Laurie's aria from it, I think, is one of the best arias in English ever written. We're doing it with Dawn Upshaw this year, by the way, on Evening at Pops. But this piece, in the text of this piece, optimism and the glory of what it represents is really inspiring, and this is a piece that I also never grow tired of working with.
Mary, that call was providential. Thank you for reminding us of The Promise of Living. 1-800-423-8255. John is calling from Lanesville, Indiana.
Yes, good morning.
Welcome, John.
Well, just a couple of ramblings here. I was listening to the conversation and just thinking in terms of the resonance of Copland's music with Americans. And, you know, there's got to be some correlation with the open string guitar and the open string instruments that are very common to our folk culture. And wondering where this gentleman from New York or Brooklyn got the music brings me to my own experience, where I think composition really, we composers are basically filters. We're nothing more than receptors sometimes, I believe, kind of spiritual. But, you know, it's there. It's an ethos, and sometimes we're tuned in and sometimes we're not. And one last observation. I believe you were an old student of Jay Bocook, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Wow. Well, actually, Jay was too young to have been my teacher. He was just a couple years ahead of me. But we both went to Furman, and when I was down there, he was teaching at Travelers Rest High School in South Carolina.
Okay.
But I know Jay, and he's a great arranger, actually, with a lot of credits these days.
Well, great. And I really enjoyed the conversation, and I'll let you go on and observe some more about Copland.
I do like
Pick up the open string guitar.
I do like that comment, actually, and that's something that I hadn't thought about. What people talk about when they do actual intellectual analysis of the writing is they talk about the open spacing of the chords, the fact that his music does not sound dense and compact like a lot of early 20th century, especially European music does. Some of that, for instance, is why people have such a hard time listening to Schoenberg, because it's just so piled on top of itself. Copland's spacing of the chords is very wide open. It's chords in fifths and fourths and big, long, open harmonies with something happening way in the bass and something happening up in the treble and very little happening in between to muddy the water. So it always sounds clear. And I think that maybe he's right. The connection with folk fiddle kind of basically strummed folk guitar is that a lot of what they do is based on circles of fifths and open fifth harmonizations. So that could be very well taken.
John, wonderful call. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Alan is on the line in Buffalo. Welcome, Alan.
Hello.
Are you there, Alan? Welcome.
Yes, I am.
Thanks for calling.
You're wet. And what would you like me to say?
Whatever on your mind.
Okay. I'm a retired professor of music from the State University of New York at Buffalo.
Uh-huh.
And in 1957-58, Copland was a visiting professor here. And I got to know him fairly well. And I'm also a retired first clarinetist from the Buffalo Philharmonic. And his clarinet concerto was written in 48 for Benny Goodman. And by this time, it was circulating, and I was planning to play it at a new concert. And I played a little bit of it for Copland in a little practice room. And he said, "It's okay, you do it fine." He said, "However, I just returned from a tour of Europe where this was played several times, various large cities. But," he said, "they didn't get the hang of it." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, they weren't into jazz. They didn't know how to play it." And, of course, now that's completely different, because everybody all over the world, all clarinetists can play it.
Well, I think it's funny that I love that piece. Actually, my orchestral background is as a clarinetist myself, though I'm pretty retired these days. But I've done the piece a few times. I did it with Stoltzman up in Montreal a couple of years ago, and I'm doing it with my principal clarinet out in Utah in this next fall.
Who
as part
is
of
that?
Our his name is Tad Calcara, a young guy.
Uh-huh.
Just got out of New World.
Yeah.
I should have mentioned earlier on that Keith Lockhart has a day job in Boston with the Pops, and he the rest of the year
moonlighting
he moonlights as a very eminent conductor of the Utah Symphony.
But one of the things that's always struck me about that piece is, you're right, a whole lot of clarinetists get it now, get the vernacular. But the piece remains monstrously difficult to put together because the string writing is so hard to get a string section to put some of those rhythms together, especially on the kind of pressure cooker that you know that orchestras rehearse under, is the biggest challenge of that piece.
Alan, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. The Copland Connection with Maestro Keith Lockhart. Steve is on the line.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, yes. Well, I'm calling especially in light of the previous comment about where composers get their inspiration. I think it's either telling or ironic, depending on your viewpoint, the fact that Copland was a homosexual Jew. And I would be curious to see what the sort of more widespread dissemination of this would result in terms of the public perception towards him, possible political responses from certain directions, and so on.
Well, it was not exactly a secret. Certainly not that he was Jewish. Certainly, certainly in the music world, that he was homosexual.
He was a very discreet, private person, and he didn't make a big point of any of his leanings, but I think it's pretty much a matter of the public record now. But I think, you know, the body of work speaks for itself. And I think what's most remarkable about this is that, as one of our previous callers said, a good composer is a receptor of influences. And the fact that he could capture so many influences that seem to be completely outside of his background, I think, is one thing that makes him extraordinary.
He was also, he was not baited or penalized, as far as I know, for his homosexuality. He was baited somewhat about his lefty affiliations in the 30s, and he was described as a sort of fellow traveler, but he claimed he'd never been a communist or a member of the party, and it seemed to blow over.
He was never a member of the Communist Party, and he was, even by the time of the McCarthy hearings in the 50s, he was such an American icon that it would have been difficult to take him on. But in the 20s and 30s, the people he associated with were the Mark Blitzsteins and Harold Clermans of the world, and people who had very distinct leftist New York intellectual leanings. So probably some of that accusation had a little bit of founding in it.
Steve, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes the Aaron Copland connection with the conductor, Keith Lockhart of the Boston Pops. Would you cue, with whatever introduction you want, the Circus March from The Red Pony, one of his movie scores?
Sure. Copland actually did not do a lot of writing for films. He greatly respected people who did. He had, I think, three films to his credit that were of major import. One was Of Mice and Men. One was the film version of Our Town, the Thornton Wilder play. And the other was The Red Pony, which is certainly a film I remember from my childhood.
He also did The Heiress.
Oh, that's right.
Henry James's Washington
right.
Square. Yeah.
Well, there's four. And there's probably a fifth one that I left out. And there's several documentaries and things like that he was involved in as well. But The Red Pony
was Steinbeck. Right?
Is the filming of the Steinbeck novel, 1949, and it's a piece, I think, a film that was really eminently suited to Copland and his sensibilities as a composer at that time. We're going to play the Circus March from The Red Pony again. This is the Boston Pops and my illustrious predecessor, John Williams.
Aaron Copland's Circus March from the movie music for The Red Pony. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Copland connection. Jill is on the line.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Jill.
I think that most people or general public tend to think of Copland as a big sweeping composer, but one of my favorite works of his is a setting of the 12 poems of Emily Dickinson.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the pleasure to hear Sanford Sullivan sing it, it must have been 12 years ago. And I was wondering about your feelings on those quieter works of his, and I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Jill.
Well, I think, my favorite moments in Copland's output are the quiet moments, the intimate moments, the less grand gesture moments. For instance, in Appalachian Spring, my favorite part is not the huge choral retelling of The Gift to Be Simple. My favorite part is the ending, the prayer at the end where the couple is left, as the scenario from Martha Graham says, quiet and content in their new home together. The eight poems of Emily Dickinson, I think 1953, I think, wonderful settings of a really quirky, original American poet. But the funny thing is about them is they were completely panned. Even as I said, Copland was extremely popular at the time. There was not a critic who liked them. Copland, by that point, had learned to take these things with a grain of salt, and he wrote a letter to Bernstein that said, and they were so universally hated that I figured that I must have written something good.
We don't have those cued, Jill. Next time, and we'll talk about Copland again.
Come back in November.
Yeah, we'll do it. 1-800-423-8255, the Copland Connection. Judy is on the line.
Hi, Chris. Enjoy your show very much.
Thank you, Judy.
And, Keith, I'd like to ask you to comment on Copland's, I think he titled it the Short Symphony, which he then rescored for Sextet. He wrote it in the mid-30s, I believe. And I guess when an American orchestra was supposed to, I believe, premiere it, they just found it incredibly difficult. The first movement is very, very hard rhythmically. And they basically said they couldn't perform it. There wasn't enough rehearsal time. And he subsequently rescored it. Are you familiar with this?
I am familiar with the piece. I have never done the piece, and I know kind of in a vague way all of the bits of the story that you're talking about. And I'm here thumbing through a couple of notes I have, trying to see if I can come up with some better information for it. It is an extraordinarily difficult piece, and it dates kind of from Copland's kind of thornier period of doing things. The person who was the early champion of that piece, actually, an interesting thing was that Copland, I don't know if you know, spent a good deal of the late 20s and mid-30s hanging out in Mexico. He loved the country, loved the people, and was a huge fan of Carlos Chavez, who was kind of the Mexican Copland. And Chavez's favorite piece of Copland's was the Short Symphony, which he gave its Mexican premiere a couple of years after it was premiered in this country. And supposedly, according to somebody asked Copland how the performance was with the National Orchestra of Mexico, and he said, "It was a mess, but it was a very pretty mess."
We'll play a little of the El Salón Mexico on our way out. But first, 1-800-423-8255 makes the Copland Connection. Joe is on the line.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good, Joe.
Good. I'm a student and conductor of music for wind band, and Copland is one of the guys that we sort of latch onto as a accepted conductor who did indeed write for that medium. And I was wondering what your insight was. Like, there are several pieces. First of all, his music transcribes very well for band, but there are several pieces originally for the wind band. I was wondering if you had any insight on that.
What are the pieces originally for the wind band?
Well, for instance, he wrote a piece called Emblems in 1965, which was commissioned by the College Band Directors National Association. And there are two or three others. El Salón Mexico is a very commonly done piece by band.
Very commonly. In my band days in college, I played the transcription of that. Also,
right.
An outdoor overture is transcribed for band.
Exactly. There's a pretty good one of the big push from Appalachian Spring, the Shaker Melody, the Lincoln Portrait is done for band as well. That translates very
right.
well.
Done that as well. I think one of the things that strikes me about Copland is that he was very user-oriented in his writing, even in his younger and thornier days. He was not a musical snob. He wrote, as I said, he wrote Down a Country Lane for a magazine, for mass publication, because he thought it was important to put some of this, what the Germans call Gebrauchsmusik, out in front of average people. And thus, I think the college band director's thing, too, was an attempt to have a great composer writing for as many different mediums as possible.
Let's go out on El Salon, Mexico. This is performed again by the Boston Pops, but under the venerable Arthur Fiedler, from the Pops CD, An American Salute.
Just a little note on this, Chris, by the way. For the first time since this recording, the Pops will be re-recording this year on Aladdin album.
Under Keith Lockhart. Keith Lockhart, enormous thanks to you for all you do and for joining us on The Connection this hour. The Boston Pops is going to be celebrating the music of Aaron Copland throughout the season, which runs from now till July. Thank you, Keith. We had help today from John Hoder, John Marston, Glenn Alexander, Ted Curry, Carl Volker, Allison Bagg, Rebecca Smuckler, and Kim Bichari. The Connection is produced by Catherine Bidwell, Hitesh Hathi, John Holt, Jill Kaufman, Amy McDonald, Jim Norris, and Keith Shields. Mary McGrath is our maestro. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by MassMedic, representing the Bay State's medical device community, holding its fourth annual conference and investor session May 8th, and a boot camp for startup and